This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting and the taste, lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com. This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting and the taste, lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
It's January 5th, 1976, days before Super Bowl IV. The Kansas City Chiefs have arrived in New Orleans, and their quarterback, Len Dawson, a 34-year-old former NFL castoff who rebuilt his career in the American Football League, is preparing for the biggest game of his life. And then the phone rings. NBC News anchor David Brinkley tells America what comes next. A federal gambling investigation has swept through Detroit. The IRS has arrested a man named Donald Dawson, no relation to Len, in a hotel room, confiscating gambling records and $450,000 in cash. When the investigators pull the phone records, they find calls to a small group of NFL players. One of the names on that list was Len Dawson. The report falls on the Chiefs' hotel quarters, in the words of the Chicago Sun-Times, like a bottle of acid. Len Dawson has 6 days to clear his name and 6 days to prepare for the Minnesota Vikings, a team that has lost exactly two games all season, a team led by the most feared defense in professional football, and a team favored by 13.5 points. This is a story of Super Bowl IV, the last war between the two leagues, and the coach who called his own highlights and the quarterback who played for his freedom. Hello, everybody. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we are celebrating the season of 1969. And today we're going to talk a little bit about the trouble that happened and was brewing before the 1970 Super Bowl, the January 1970 Super Bowl, which is Super Bowl IV, the culmination of the 1969 season. Now, to understand what happened at Tulane Stadium on January 11, 1970, you have to understand what was ending. The American Football League began play in 1960. There was 8 teams, and they were nicknamed the Foolish Club by the established NFL. Now, for 6 years, the two leagues had fought a bitter, expensive war. They raided each other's rosters. They outbid each other for college stars, and the NFL called the AFL a Mickey Mouse League. The AFL called the NFL a monopoly. Well, on June 8, 1966, the war ended. The two leagues announced a merger, and they would play a common draft beginning in 1967. They would meet in a championship game, the AFL-NFL World Championship game, later renamed the Super Bowl, at the end of each season. And in 1970, they would become one league, the National Football Conference and the American Football Conference, under a single banner of the NFL. Now, the merger was supposed to be a formality, a recognition that the NFL is a superior league, generously absorbing its little brother. Green Bay won the first two Super Bowls by a combined score of 68-24. The narrative held still. Now, then came Super Bowl III, January of 1969. Joe Namath guaranteed victory, and the New York Jets beat the Baltimore Colts 16-7. The AFL had won its first championship, but the NFL establishment called it a fluke. Namath got lucky. The Colts had a bad day. Excuse after excuse. The real test would come the next year when the Vikings, the best team in the NFL had produced in over a decade, would face whoever survived in the AFL. Now, that 1969 Minnesota Vikings team was a machine. 12 wins, 2 losses, the longest single winning streak in the 35 years, 12 straight. They had led the NFL in points scored, 379. The fewest points allowed, just 133. And they scored 50 or more points in 3 different games. Now, the defense was anchored by the line they called the Purple People Eaters. Alan Page, Carl Eller, Jim Marshall, and Gary Larson. The second featured Paul Krause, the future all-time interceptions leader, and Bobby Bryant, who had picked off 8 passes just that season. It was not just a good defense, it was a defense people were afraid to play against. The quarterback was Joe Kapp, and unlike anyone in the league, he didn't slide. He lowered his shoulder, and when he was voted the Vikings' most valuable player, Kapp said, "There is no one most valuable Viking. There are 40 most valuable Vikings." Now, the Chiefs, by contrast, had limped into the playoffs. Their quarterback had missed 6 games with a knee injury. Their backup quarterback had broken his ankle in the very next week. And a third-string quarterback, a kid named Mike Livingston, won 5 of his next 6 starts to keep that season alive. They finished 11-3, second in the AFL West, behind the 12-1-1 Oakland Raiders. The new playoff format, expanded to 4 teams in its first and only year before the merger, sent the Chiefs on the road. They beat the defending champion Jets in New York, 13-6. Then they went to Oakland to face a Raiders team that had beaten them 7 of the last 8 meetings. In this contest, the Chiefs won 17-7. They were the champions of the American Football League. And for the last time, as it turned out, the AFL Championship game would never be played again. And waiting for them in New Orleans, the Minnesota Vikings, 13.5-point favorites, the best team in football, the NFL's chosen champion. Now, to understand why Super Bowl IV mattered the way it did, you have to understand the man who played quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs. Len Dawson was the 5th overall pick in the 1957 NFL draft. The Pittsburgh Steelers selected him out of Purdue, where he had led the nation in passing efficiency, and he arrived in the NFL as a first-round talent with a first-round arm. And then he sat for 3 seasons. He sat behind Bobby Lane in Pittsburgh, throwing a total of 45 passes in 3 years. And in 1960, the Steelers traded him to Cleveland. There he sat behind Milt Plum. 2 more seasons, 17 more passes, 5 NFL seasons, 62 total passes, a first-round pick buried on the bench. In 1962, a man named Hank Stram, the head coach of the AFL's Dallas Texans, called Dawson and asked him a simple question: "Do you still want to play football?" Well, Dawson immediately answered yes and instantly became one of the best quarterbacks in professional football. In his first season as a starter, he led the league in touchdown passes and yards per attempt. In 1962, he led the Texans to the AFL Championship, an epic double overtime win over the Houston Oilers that remains one of the greatest games in league history. By 1969, he was 34 years old. He'd won 3 AFL championships, and he'd been named AFL Player of the Year. He was building a Hall of Fame resume, and he was doing it in a league that the NFL still refused to fully respect. Now, then in November of 1969, 2 months before the Super Bowl, the season started caving in. Dawson suffered a knee injury in the second game of the year, and he missed 6 weeks. The backup, Jackie Lee, broke his ankle the very next Sunday. And on November 15th, the day before a crucial game against the defending champion Jets, Dawson's father died of a heart attack. 2 days later, Len Dawson took the field in New York and led the Chiefs to a 34-16 victory over the Jets. He threw for 2 touchdowns, and his teammates years later said they couldn't believe that he even played at all. Now, this is a man preparing for Super Bowl IV, a quarterback who had been discarded by the NFL, a quarterback playing through grief, a quarterback who had spent his entire career fighting the idea that the league he played in wasn't good enough. And now, 6 days before the biggest game of his life, the national news had just told America his name was found in a federal gambling investigation. This couldn't be good. But the facts of the investigation were straightforward. A Detroit restaurateur named Donald Dawson, nicknamed Dice, had been arrested by IRS agents in a hotel room. They had found gambling records. They found $450,000. And then they pulled his telephone records and they found calls to several NFL players, all of whom had lived in Bloomfield, Michigan at the various points. Now, one of these players was Len Dawson. The 2 men shared a last name but no relation, and Dawson had known him as a casual acquaintance from his years in the Detroit area. Now, the calls were social, brief, and consequential, but in the context of a federal gambling investigation, the week of the Super Bowl, the nuance didn't matter. NBC ran with the story on the evening news. Every newspaper in the country picked it up. Suddenly, the quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs, the face of the AFL in its last stand, was linked, however, tenuously to an organized gambling ring. Now, the NFL had been there before. In 1963, Commissioner Pete Rozelle suspended Paul Hornung and Alex Karras, two of its stars, for the entire season for betting on NFL games. The league's position was absolute. Any association with gambling was an existential threat to the integrity of the sport. Now, the Chiefs' participation in the Super Bowl was reportedly discussed at the highest levels in the league office. Now, Dawson called a press conference. Cameras crowded in, reporters shouted questions, and Len Dawson, this man who had sat for 5 years in the NFL, who'd rebuilt his career in a league the establishment mocked, who had buried his father 2 months earlier and played through it, was now 6 days from the Super Bowl with his reputation under siege. He stood at the microphone and faced them all. He told the truth. He did know Donald Dawson as a casual acquaintance, but he never discussed football with him in any inappropriate way. He had never bet on a game, never provided inside information, never done anything that compromised the sport he had given his life to. He acknowledged that he had exercised poor judgment in even knowing a person like that. But the NFL investigated, and days later, Commissioner Pete Rozelle issued a statement. Len Dawson was fully cleared. There was no evidence of any wrongdoing, and he would play in Super Bowl IV. But the damage, the human damage, was done. Dawson later said those 6 days were among the worst of his life. Had to be agonizing for the quarterback. Now, he was asked if he had ever been so angry that he couldn't sleep. He paused, and then he said, "Let's just say this. I didn't sleep much that week." Now, the man who would start Super Bowl IV was a man who had spent 6 days defending his own name and who would now spend 60 minutes of football defending the league he had carried on his back. On January 11, 1970, at Tulane Stadium in New Orleans, Louisiana, 80,562 in attendance, the 42 million others watching on CBS, a 30-second commercial, $78,000, and a national anthem by Doc Severinsen with Pat O'Brien, and halftime, the Southern University Band reenacting the Battle of New Orleans. Now, the weather was wet, the field was slick, and from the opening kickoff, the Kansas City Chiefs played like a team that had something to prove in that game. The Chiefs took the opening possession and drove, not explosively, but methodically. 8 plays, 55 yards, and they stalled inside the Minnesota 20-yard line, and Hank Stram sent out the kicker. Jan Stenerud, a Norwegian who had never seen a football game until he arrived in America on a ski jumping scholarship, drilled a 48-yard field goal, the longest in Super Bowl history at the time, and there was 3-0. The Chiefs were up, and that 48-yard field goal, by the way, would stand as a record in the Super Bowl for 24 years. Now, Stenerud did it again, a 32-yard field goal, 6-0, and then a 25-yard field goal, 9-0. The AFL's underdogs were up 9 points on the NFL's best team, and they hadn't even scored a touchdown yet. But they were moving the ball against these Purple People Eater defense, but they could not cross a goal line. They held true, did Minnesota, when they got in the red zone. Then late in the first half, Hank Stram made the call that would become legend. NFL Films, for the first time in Super Bowl history, had placed a wireless microphone on the head coach. And Hank Stram, flamboyant, brilliant, cocky, wore it on the sidelines with pride. And then when he looked at the Minnesota defense and saw exactly what he wanted, he didn't just call a play into his headset. He narrated it. 65 toss power trap, Stram said, calling the play just before it happened. There it is. Yeah. Mike Garrett took the handoff, followed his blockers, and walked into the end zone. 16-0, Chiefs Stram grinned on the sidelines and said into the microphone the words that would define his legacy. Quote, "Just keep articulating the ball down the field, boys." Now, that was one of the quotes that we always see legendary when the Sables play that on NFL Films. Now, in the third quarter, the Vikings finally broke through. Dave Osborne punched it in from the 4 yards out. Kansas City 16, Minnesota 7. The NFL champions had some life. and then the Chiefs came back. They drove down the field deep into Minnesota territory. Dawson dropped back. He looked downfield, and he saw Otis Taylor, the wide receiver, running a quick slant, and Dawson released the ball. Taylor caught it at the 35-yard line. Ursel Maccabee, the Vikings defensive back, lunged for the tackle, and Taylor stiff-armed him with a single arm, a violent shove that sent Maccabee spinning to the turf, and Taylor turned upfield and ran and crossed the goal line. A 46-yard touchdown. Kansas City had the lead, 23-7, and the Vikings had nothing left. The defense, the Purple People Eaters, had been dissected. Joe Capp threw two interceptions. The Chiefs recovered two fumbles, and the Vikings managed just 67 rushing yards all afternoon. The NFL's best offense, the most feared defense, were shut down by the AFL champions and their offense and defense. Final score was 23-7, and the American Football League won its second straight Super Bowl. The series was tied, and the merger was supposed to be the NFL absorbing the inferior rival, would happen on the AFL's terms. Now, Len Dawson was named Super Bowl MVP of that game, and he completed 12 of 17 passes for 142 yards and a touchdown. He was the fourth consecutive winning quarterback to win the award, and he had done it in 6 days after his name had been dragged through the national news. Playing the game of his life, we need to have built everything and put it on the line. The 1969 Kansas City Chiefs sent 11 men to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Len Dawson, Hank Stram, Bobby Bell, Buck Buchanan, Willie Lanier, Curly Culp, Johnny Robinson, Jan Stenerud, Emmett Thomas, and owner Lamar Hunt. And later, kick returner Nolan Smith's teammate Otis Taylor, who belongs in Canton and maybe still debated today, one of the greatest wide receivers in NFL history. Now, the Chiefs could not win or appear in another Super Bowl for 50 years until 2020 when Patrick Mahomes led them back to the summit. Now, Jan Stenerud became the first pure place kicker inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1991. As a distinction, he had held alone for more than two decades. And the Norwegian ski jumper, who had never seen a football game, retired it with 1,699 points in respect of the entire sport. And scoring those first 9 points to put the Chiefs up was very helpful. Hank Stram waited 26 years for his Hall of Fame induction. Coach Stram finally was enshrined in 2003, mic'd up footage from the Super Bowl IV, having become the most iconic piece of NFL Films audio ever recorded up to that point. And Len Dawson, he retired in 1975 and entered into the Hall of Fame in 1987. He spent decades as one of the most beloved broadcasters in football, calling Chiefs games, hosting HBO's Inside the NFL, and becoming the voice of a franchise. He passed away August 24th, 2022, at the age of 87 years old. Super Bowl IV was the last game of the American Football League. The merger took effect the following season, and the AFL's teams becoming the American Football Conference of a single National Football League. The Super Bowl, once a grudging compromise between the warring leagues, became the single biggest annual event in American sports. And at the center of it, a quarterback who'd been cut by the NFL, buried on a depth chart for 5 years, told he wasn't good enough, a quarterback who lost his father 2 months before the Super Bowl and played anyway, and a quarterback who had 6 days to clear his name and 60 minutes to prove to a league that he belonged. He did both. He walked into Tulane Stadium under a cloud. He walked out with a championship, an MVP trophy, and a place in history that no investigation, no narrative, and no league establishment could take from him. Len Dawson, the man who kept playing for his name in the last war the AFL ever had to fight. Now, next time on the Gridiron Timeline, we are going to travel back to 1983. What a year that was. We have some great guests coming on. We're going to be talking about many of the quarterbacks, as you can imagine, some of the big games in college and in the NFL, just like we are the rest of this week. This week, we're celebrating 1969. But you can find any year that we have listed up right now. We're releasing a new year every single day, going chronologically. But you can go to the pigskindispatch.com and visit our timelines. Go by day of the year, go by month of the year, go by every year, and you'll see what we're talking about. But all of our podcasts, all of our YouTube videos and our YouTube shorts, and many of our articles are focused on the year of the week on the Gridiron Timeline. And this year, 1969, a very special one indeed. Hope you enjoyed this segment on football history. Glad you could join us. Tune in next time as we talk some more football history. Until then, everybody, have a great Gridiron Day.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.
Hi, this is Joe Ziumba, and I'm the host of the podcast When Football Was Football here on the Sports History Network. This podcast is based on stories, events, and characters from my book called When Football Was Football, The Chicago Cardinals and the Birth of the NFL, which was written shortly after the Cardinals won their last championship in 1947, or so it seems. The reason for this message is twofold. First, to share the great news that the second edition of the book has just been released by McFarland Publishers, and all Sports History Network listeners can now enter a special Sports History Network contest for the opportunity to win one of two free copies of When Football Was Football. We'll be happy to include a personal inscription in each winner's book and then send it out to you with our best wishes. The new book contains about 80 more pages than the original, almost all new archival photos, additions within all chapters based on new research, and an update on the players, coaches, and administrators mentioned in the book. It's everything you ever wanted to know about the early Cardinals, as well as the NFL itself. To enter this free giveaway, go to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. Thank you.